am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
Looking for a dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello, and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast to our knowledge to go through that wonderful 1986 movie Highlander, scene by glorious scene. I'm your host, Rob Daniel, and as always, I am thrilled to say I'm joined by my kinsman, Mr. Rob Wallace.
And as always, it's a real pleasure to be here.
And we are flying solo. Can it be solo if there's two of us? I don't know. But we are just one entity now, aren't we? We've come so far down the line with Highlander. We are one entity. Called Rob.
We are the Rob.
We are the Rob. And yeah, so this is just the two of us today.
It's not like our lives are intertwined in any other ways recently.
Yes, that's right. Yes, because Rob and I now share the same office every Tuesday because I have also started working at his place of employment. So yeah, that's nice. It was interesting on Tuesday just gone to go into the office and it's like, oh, my first office job for a few years, and Mr. Wallace is there to welcome me, literally, because I couldn't find the office.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, I left Sky after you left Sky, so that means, you know, yeah, how long has it been since you've worked an office job that I wasn't around in some capacity?
Has it been? Before May of 2014.
So eight years, let's say.
Yeah, dude, yeah. Wow, okay. So anyway, this is just the kind of thing that people who've tuned in to listen to a Highlander-themed podcast want to hear which office I work in. But it was nice. It was very nice. Yeah, so our lives are intertwining, so we are now just the entity known as Rob. Yeah, so it's just the two of us today, and we have some more of the climax to talk about. It's actually really, really building up to the end of the climax now, because we're going to be talking about the sequence from when Connor and the Kurgan are fighting in the flooded rooftop of the Silver Cup building, and Brenda is having to try and save herself around them, to the point when they crash through the skylight and fall into the big warehouse space. So for those who like to follow along, this is the sequence that goes from 1 hour 45 minutes 12 seconds to 1 hour and 46 minutes and 47 seconds. So that's 1:45:12 to 1:46:47. So, this is a good sequence to talk about. There's lots of things going on, but so I'm not the only voice you're going to hear. Rob, what do you think about this particular sequence?
Having rewatched it a few times recently, I hadn't quite appreciated this. It's a really dynamic sequence. I mean, as you say, there's lots going on. You've got Connor and the Kurgan battling in the electrified water, and yep, literally, you know, in the opening moment of this of the section that we're talking about, you've got that very Ghostbusters blue post-production electricity crackling up the side of that girder, of the wrecked girder that's kind of sticking out of the water.
Yeah, and that really is, I think we might have mentioned it before, but that is such an 80s effect. It immediately timestamps it. That blue lightning is something that was kind of perfected around the mid-80s. So you got it in things like Back to the Future, but you also got it in things like Life Force, the Tobey Hooper film. And
I think this might be the second consecutive episode where we've mentioned Life Force.
Oh, really?
The mighty Life Force.
I feel a Life Force minute by minute coming on.
They waited. Now their time has come. Out of the depths of space, the ultimate terror. Moving, searching, destroying. From body to body, from life to life, from man to woman, changing, growing, burning for our life force. From the director of Poltergeist, from the special effects creator of Star Trek, the motion picture, Life Force. In the blink of an eye, the terror begins.
We can't sustain that.
We should watch the film again just to see how far we can get into it. Life Force is mad, even madder than Highlander, but not as well put together. Anyway, but the, yeah, so that really, really timestamps it, doesn't it? The blue lightning.
Yes, and I like that, you know, this is essentially a more extreme version of the car park fight that opens, the one with Fazeal in the Madison Square Garden car park.
McLeod.
Fazeal. Wait.
Because, you know, it's electricity and water again, but on, like, an industrial scale.
Yes, it really is, isn't it? It's, and this does bring in the elements. The thing that I like about this particular sequence is how it quite subtly pays off a lot of the things that have been seeded in the film from the very beginning of the movie. So as you were saying, this is like a return to the very, very first fight in the film in the car park.
Ah, but in this, of course, they've gone high rather than low.
They have, that's right, yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point as well, because he is a Highlander, not a Lowlander. And Lowlander is the name of a very, very good restaurant in Covent Garden, if you're ever in London and want good Belgian food.
And Outlander is a sci-fi dystopian movie starring Sean Connery. Is it Outlander? Outland.
Outland. But Outlander is a very, very good sci-fi movie starring Jim Caviezel when he wasn't being mad. It's a sci-fi monster movie.
And isn't also that time travel Scottish Rome?
Yes, it is. That's right, yeah. It's one that my mum loves. But yeah, but we were talking about the way that this brings in the different elemental parts of being an immortal that we've seen throughout the film. So do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yes, and obviously, yeah, because you've got, during their sword fight, and Kogan kind of shoves Connor, who just disappears sideways underwater.
Yes.
Like, it's almost like, you know, I guess like one of those targets at a fairground. It just goes bloop. And he vanishes sideways, and the water's clearly quite deep, although apparently not deep enough to go over the edge of the building.
Yeah.
Like, that you don't have water spilling off into
the street, that's right.
And the Kurgan's clearly a bit, like, I don't know, nonplussed, annoyed. Like, he starts, like jabbing at the bit of water that Connor's just vanished into with his sword, being like, oh, where'd he go? But obviously, it's because mortals can survive underwater. They can breathe underwater.
Yeah, indeed. So we've seen that in the lock earlier with Ramirez, when, I can't swim. You can't drown, you fool. You're immortal.
Help me, I'm drowning!
You can't drown, you fool. You're immortal.
And then I will sample the wonderful Christopher Lambert laughing underwater.
Oh, yes. But yeah, what I like about this is that, yeah, you've had, in the fight with Fazeal, you had the elements. So you had the lightning when the quickening happens, and then that set off all the sprinklers. The first time that Connor meets Ramirez, a storm breaks out. So you have a thunderstorm and you get struck by lightning.
The sensation you're feeling is the quickening.
So immortality has been denoted by those two elements through the entire film, really. So it's really nice that they brought it back here as well. And it's just a nice little payoff. It's one of those things where it's like, you don't, I mean, to be completely honest, I didn't really realise that until we were watching it for this. But it's one of those things that subliminally is just there, that kind of imagery feeds in to have a certain visual consistency through the film. And maybe, you know,
I do like in this, because Russell Mackay is obviously very much a visual director, and a lot of this was done for, you know, not this isn't being, might be dismissive, for the sake of cool, that usually you'd think, you know, you'd look at something thematically and then work and then extrapolate what it's going to look like visually. In this, it's kind of reverse. It's like, you know, it's the visuals informing the themes.
I think so, yeah. But it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, cool, because of course, Christopher Lambert came from cinéma de look, which was a thing in the early 80s that was kind of a derogatory term by critics to say that films being made in the early 80s, like Diva and Subway, were all surface and no substance, and sheen was the only thing that they had to offer. Which I think is slightly unfair. I think the further away you get from that, the more it becomes a record of that time and the attitudes of that time. And if you're in the time, then you might not be able to see it as well. I think one of the things that can be said is that they are much more interested in the visuals and atmosphere than they are in, like, a compelling story. Because Diva is, it's a good movie, but it is a bit slow. And Subway is a good movie, but it is a bit slow sometimes and a bit dull. But Christopher Lambert came out of that. But I wonder if Russell Mulcahy would say, actually, I think you're being a bit unfair there, because it's not so much cool. It's visually, I'm interested in something being visually arresting, visually entertaining, because I'm a visual storyteller. I don't want you to pay your money to come to the cinema to watch something that looks dull.
Yeah, I'm not, yeah, sorry, I say cool, that does sound dismissive, you know, they're not on the roof wearing Doc sunglasses. And then sort of disappearing under the surface of the water, and Connor kind of pops up. I mean, we'll talk about Brenda in a minute. We've forgotten to talk about Brenda, as the film often forgets about her. But Connor emerges, and you've got the red light playing along the surface. It's not quite clear what the source is, because it's quite a lot of red light for just the one remaining S.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Because the... I mean, I suppose it's one of those things where it is quite a big S, so you could kind of justify it from that, but it does look like as if it's been completely washed by a big red key light, but yeah.
Yeah, the big S. Yeah.
The big S.
The fall of the big S. and then the Kurgan suddenly rises up behind him, basically roaring, and the electricity crackling from him. Which again confirms the fact, you know, the water is electrified, you know, and it's not affecting them in much the way that the fall they are shortly to undergo doesn't actually affect them.
Yeah.
Because if it did, they're in there. It's like they're not dying, but they are twitching a bit.
And there's no point in this film where someone gets electrified and it momentarily stops them, is there? Am I thinking? For some reason, I seem to.
There's the bit in the underground thing where Connor accidentally hits the pipe with the steam and the steam comes out and gets him, but I don't think there's a moment where.
No, because I'm trying to think. For some reason, I have an image in my head of the Kurgan being stunned and immobilized by an electric charge, but I'm just imagining that.
Are you just thinking of The Quickening?
No. I'm thinking of a different film, I think. I'm thinking of a film where the monster gets hit by a charge and it momentarily stops them, and just thinking, oh, that's the Kurgan, because of course
it's a very movie monster moment, this. Yes. It's very Friday the 13th, it's, you know, with Jason Voorhees, and you know, the Kurgan is a kind of larger-than-life, cackling villain. But the film does occasionally remember, like, oh no, he's also a physical... You know, he's physically imposing. He's a scary... He's actually quite a terrifying person.
Hmm.
You know, more simply than just he's going to, you know, sing New York, New York while they're speeding through the city. He's not... Yeah, he's not just... Beneath the sense of malevolent fun, there is also somebody who's an actual threat.
Yeah, indeed, and that's... really ties into what we talked about before in terms of he looks like a slasher villain, but he also looks like the Terminator. Here I think it's been played much more for slasher villain. Because of course there is a thing in slasher movies where the monster will appear from the water. So the end of Friday the 13th has a shock ending for those who haven't seen it. It's not the best film in the world, to be honest. But a bald mutant comes up out of the lake and gets the final girl. That's then returned to in Friday the 13th Part 2. But also films...
Almost like they were setting up a franchise.
Yes, indeed. Which they realised that they could stumble into. But The Burning, which didn't become a franchise, but was an early film that was produced by the Weinsteins. That's just one of its problems in terms of the sexual politics of the movie. But The Burning always holds a special place in my heart because it was the... I think that was the first slasher film I saw. My auntie rented it when she was babysitting me one night. My parents were none too pleased that I'd seen this film. It was quite a famous video nasty in its day. But the Tom Savini effects were amazing. Anyway, there's a point in that when he appears, actually I think it's up out of a canoe that they find because all of their canoes get stolen. So they build a raft, go out into the middle of this lake to get the canoes back. And he's in there, the killer with his shears. Oh, it's one of the great movie moments, that is. And you've got The Burning on your shelf, haven't you?
I think I do.
The Arrow release, which is very good. Anyway, yeah, so that was like another image that you would get in these films, in these slasher films from the 80s. The the monster would come up out of the water at some point. And of course, as we talked about before, there's a lot of Terminator in the Kurgan too.
Yes, lots of leather.
Which is, again, well, it reads into the queer reading of this film, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
But also just the homoeroticism.
Of soaking wet leather at this point.
And 80s action cinema. I mean, the end of Rocky 3, that bit when Apollo and Rocky walk out for that private boxing match, and they're in those vulcanized rubber thongs, oiled to within an inch of their life, and it's like...
No TV, no newspapers, just you and me.
Nothing, just you and me. Age before beauty.
Anything you say, Stan.
I do all the work, okay.
I remember a time when that was just what you would get in 80s action movies, because of course the 80s was so body conscious with Jane Fonda and all the workout videos, but also a lot of the action heroes were men like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, weren't they like basically in a competition to see who could have the lowest like body fat ratio?
Yeah.
Stallone's talked about that. Like Stallone's talking about having that degree of competition with Arnie and being like, oh yeah, he got more ripped, so I got more ripped. So
in Rocky 3, Stallone went down to 3% body fat. And he wrote and directed the film as well as starring in it. I mean, the guy's clearly very intelligent and very, very talented. But he said, being at 3% body fat, he said, yes, amazing. You feel like you've got so much power. I mean, to get back to Highlander, almost like an immortal. But he said, you are constantly hyper aware of everything, but slightly removed from everything. Your senses are like, he said, you feel woozy all of the time, but you're very, very aware of everything going on around you. But he said, I wouldn't recommend staying at 3% body fat.
Yes, you know. Obviously, Stallone's in the kind of the pantheon of, you know, up there with Wells and Chaplin having, you know, neither of them have had a 3% body fat.
No, particularly Wells.
Yeah, Wells was kind of just completely the other way.
Indeed.
And had a wonderful time doing it.
He was 3% muscle. Yeah. Which anyone knows me is saying, all right, so you're really, because when were you 3% body fat, Rob? I don't think I've ever achieved that either. Must be very hard to get 3% body fat. Anyway.
You tried, you broke your foot.
I did, that's right, yes. Yeah, when I tried
to
get into shape.
You tried to do a Stallone, which meant I couldn't go to Japan.
Yeah, when I tried to get into shape. Yeah, when I tried to get to 3% body fat, I smashed my foot in the gym and Rob couldn't go to Japan because we couldn't, well, I couldn't fly anymore. So our holiday had to get cancelled. Anyway. So, yeah, so that's, again, that's like another thing that comes back here. This, it is good the way that the climax brings back some of the elements that have been seeded. I do like that about it.
And then, yeah, so Connor gets hit again and disappears back under the water, having kind of, you know, risen to meet the Kurgan's blade. At this point, going back to the film remembers that Brenda exists.
Well, one more thing before Brenda, and we will get to you soon, Brenda.
Who do you think you are, Rosamund Kai?
Yeah, absolutely. I do like the way that the Kurgan does that little pirouette as he goes down beneath the surface of the water.
It's fun, it's a...
But there's something almost serpentine to it. He becomes quite, I think, animalistic at that point, not in like kind of a brutish way, but just in like a predatorial way. He's like a hunter at that point and just silently goes beneath the surface.
Well, the bad guy, or the monster vanishing beneath the surface of the water when you're not expecting them to, it reminds me of a bit from A Quiet Place,
right?
When they're in like a flooded room and all of a sudden the monster just dives under the water and it's like a...
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah.
It's like a, oh, this is suddenly somehow got worse.
I didn't need another challenge. So other things that we were looking at, this is a good sequence in terms of the editing. It edits its way around certain things that it doesn't really want to spend time showing you. I'll make sense of that point when we talk about Brenda. But it is... Yeah, it is one of those things where it's kind of ruthlessly edited in a way, in terms of we're not going to give you a lot of close-ups here. This is going to be... It's weird. When you watch the climax of this film, there aren't a lot of close-ups to convey emotion. It's more about spectacle, I think.
Well, one of, you know, Clancy Brown recently said at the Edinburgh Film Festival, when he was interviewed by John Melville, that he was kind of waiting for Russell Mulcahy to direct him.
During this sequence?
Or just generally. I don't think Russell Mulcahy gave a lot of acting... tips.
Yeah.
Russell didn't ever tell me to stop doing anything, so I think I was just trying to get him to direct me. But he never bothered.
Yeah, I think we talked about it on the episode with Jesse, I think it was, when, yeah, I think that Russell Mulcahy is much more of a director who's like, you come in here and the camera's going to come around here and you can't move past that X on the floor or you'll be out of focus and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I kind of like that. It's an interesting climax of the film in terms of it delivers a spectacle, but there are certain things that it's not particularly interested in doing, which I think is quite a nice segue into, let's talk about Brenda. We need to talk about Brenda. Over to you, Rob.
Brenda, Roxanne Hart. Yes, is obviously still suspended from the sign at this point to the S. Which when you see the wide shots, it's quite, I'm assuming, we're assuming a dummy based on A, how, you know, precarious the position is and, you know, and the general lack of movement.
Good dummy, though, I thought.
It's a good dummy. It's good dummy, yeah. Work. And the S kind of tilts forward and, you know, finally kind of collapses into the water. And all of a sudden, with some clever editing, Roxanne Hart is dangling off the edge of the building. You get that, like a repeat of the kind of vertiginous POV shot that you got in the previous episode where Connor, Christopher Lambert, goes along the zip wire.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, so she goes over. And that's what I meant about the editing in terms of her hands are bound. She also has a safety hook on because the Kurgan's all about safety. So he hooks a safety hook onto her costume that obviously isn't the case. That was the film crew. It is weird how I never noticed that either when I watched it on video. I just think maybe the video wasn't as... It just didn't have the clarity or the definition to catch the glint off of the metal hook. Because that's, I think, what you notice. And then you realise, oh, yeah, it's a big, thick wire that's attaching it to that frame. Anyway, but when she goes over, you're right. She's dangling over the side of the building from the scaffolding, but she's out of the ropes that have bound her to the scaffolding, so therefore she doesn't have to get out of those. Yeah. She just has to get off of the scaffolding onto the rooftop. It's like, clearly the filmmakers didn't, oh, I'm not going to slow this down to show her getting out of the ropes. The ropes would have just come off when she fell, but not snapped her wrists. That's fine.
And then, yes, yeah, so she manages to get onto the ledge along the edge of the building, just out of the, you know, the reach of the electrified water.
I was thinking that because it's like, but it is... But the ledge of the building is wet.
Yes.
So it would still carry a charge, but it doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, it's like, I know that's been very, very pedantic. I do apologise.
And you actually get a couple of close-ups of her as she's crawling towards, she's in hard focus in the back, the back of the shot with Connor and the Kurgan kind of tussling in the foreground.
Yeah.
And yeah, the scene kind of leaves her there.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like...
Well, in all fairness, the scene leaves her there. It doesn't, like, you know, it's not like Connor and the Kurgan make a decision to leave and the film goes, don't worry about Brenda. It's like, there is a continuity of action.
Yeah, but it's one of those things, it's interesting with the close-ups of Brenda because there are, I think, a couple of other close-ups of her as well, but they're clearly there just as cutaways, just so they can match the shots of the actors fighting if they've moved a bit. So it's like, okay, right, so we have a cutaway and then they've moved position, but that's fine because you would just assume
you've had the cutaway, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So we're not going to cut from them to them in different positions. But the really interesting thing about this, though, I think, is the way that Brenda's adventure, her excellent adventure, is kind of separate to what the hero's doing. And it's not one of those that is a goal that the hero has to do. He goes there to confront the Kurgan and also to save Brenda, but doesn't really save Brenda. I mean, he does in the next episode that we'll talk about.
Yeah, he doesn't save Brenda. He doesn't untie her from the scaffold because he kind of just gets... He just falls into the Kurgan's trap immediately.
Yeah.
And...
So it's like, it's a really interesting way to do an action scene in an 80s movie. I think accidentally, because it's like, well, it's just not that interested in Brenda and Connor being together in this particular moment. It's like the way that the film up until now has said, she's the love interest, so therefore she's going to fall in love with him and he's going to fall in love with her, even though we're not really going to show you a lot of scenes that will motivate that. Whenever they see each other up until the point where she goes into the sunken lounge, it's all quite antagonistic.
Wait a minute, Nash. I want some answers.
You want? Don't you ever think about anything except what you want?
Here... It's a really interesting thing in terms of another film would have him trying to get to her and the Kurgan would be trying to stop him. And there would be two things that Connor has to do. He would have to save Brenda and he'd also have to try and face the Kurgan. But here it's like, he doesn't seem to be interested in that.
You get the impression that Connor's not a big multitasker. He's got a bit of a one-track mind.
Yes, it's that myopia. He can only look at one thing at once. But even to the point where when the S goes over, so the S on the scaffolding that Brenda is bound to, when that goes over, you don't get a shot of Connor looking at it in horror because that could, you know, be the end of Brenda. And I thought, yeah, that's just interesting that he doesn't have any reaction to what's happening to her. There's no close-up cutaway of him looking to see if she's all right or anything like that. It's very much like he's doing his thing and she's doing her thing. You could say that's actually quite empowering for the woman not to be saved by the guy. I just don't think that's what they were thinking.
I just don't think Connor has object permanence.
Yes. He is like Trump. He just has no object permanence. So if we just take away those things about the US troops in South Korea that he wants to pull out that would bring about World War III, I'll just take that off his desk. I always completely forgotten it was there. So Connor's Trump now. Wow, we've gone on a journey with this.
So is the Kurgan Biden? I don't think it was.
I think the Kurgan is probably Michael Cohen, his lawyer. Okay. But his hair's not as good. Anyway, yeah, it's just a very interesting way to do the end of your action love movie.
Action love movie?
Yeah, indeed. Like, yeah, your action love movie. This is the first time you ever talked about film, Rob. You know, the action love movie. That that phrase that everyone uses. Your mainstream action film with a romantic subplot that has yet paid off at the end.
Thank you, Robbie. Thank you for giving us our episode title.
Oh, yes, please. Please call it Action Love Movie.
Which does not sound like... Sounds like an entirely different genre.
Sounds like Sex Immortals. And the really interesting thing there is that it's like, do we... Is it that the film was thinking, well, the woman can't get too involved in the hero's struggle because that would emasculate the hero? I mean, that was, you know, it is an 80s film. We're talking about the politics of the time were quite entrenched in terms of the man is going to save the day. There's a story from it's a few years earlier, but Jaws 2... So an early script draft of Jaws 2 had Ellen Brody go out on the boat with Martin Brody at the end to go and rescue the kids and, you know, defeat the shark. Sid Sheinberg, who was the head of Universal, said, there's no way that the wife is going to be helping the hero in this movie to beat the monster, which says a lot. Says a lot about Sid and the way that he was regarding storytelling at the time and in terms of being male-female roles. But yeah, that's one of those things. But Sid Sheinberg, of course, also wouldn't like the end of Highlander because it's like, but he's not interested in the love interest. He has to go and save the love interest. Why isn't he doing that? Why is he only fighting this guy?
Yes, well, Sid Sheinberg had an issue with the end of a lot of movies.
Yes, he did, didn't he? Go on.
Yeah, so Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Famously, Terry Gilliam was forced to put out an ad in the... Was it...
Variety.
Variety, wasn't it? Yeah. Had forced to put an ad out in Variety. Sid Sheinberg, when are you going to release my picture?
Yeah. Dear Sid Sheinberg, when are you going to release my movie? Terry Gilliam. That's... Now, you think he was forced to do that.
Okay, he felt compelled to.
Yeah, he wasn't forced to do it.
Nobody forces Terry to do anything.
No, that's right.
That was not meant to be an admiring... That was a very ambivalent statement.
Ambivalent statement. But that was one of the ballsy things that he did, particularly at the time, because Brazil, of course, was 1985. Sid Sheinberg wanted to turn that into what I suppose would be best described. So, yes, he wanted to turn Brazil into what would be best described as an action love movie.
Well, it's the Love Conquers All Cut.
It's the Love Conquers All Cut, which is... So anyone who's seen Brazil knows that it's this very, very black comedy, kind of 1984, about an authoritarian state and a dreamer within that who wants to break out. Runs for about 2 hours, 15 minutes, and Sid Sheinberg had a cut that ran for 90 minutes, which is on the Criterion Collection DVD and Blu-ray.
Because, yeah, if anything you can say about, you know, Kafka-esque bureaucratic nightmares is that they're short.
Yes.
Is that, yeah, what will really get this across, the nightmarish, convoluted inescapability of this, is having it come in at a neat 90 minutes.
Well, Kafka's books were pretty short, and his short stories and stuff. But yes, there is that. It's like, it's yeah. Have you seen The Love Conquers All Cut?
Yes, it's rubbish.
Yeah, but it's fascinating. I mean, there's, because it uses alternate takes of things where the characters are given a much warmer performance. It uses scenes that aren't in the director's cut of Brazil. It uses a scene with Michael Palin where he basically just says what is going on up until that point, really to cover themselves in case they needed it, if it wasn't coming together in the edit, just so they could say to the audience, this is what's happening if we haven't done our job properly to make you follow all of this. So that's in there. It's obviously really, really clumsy because it's just... He just says everything that's been going on up until that point in the film.
But here's the question. Would Sid Sheinberg, if he'd been in charge of Highlander, would he have cut the World War II flashback? Or would you have got that with the American release?
That's a really good point. He would have left that in.
Yeah.
Because he knows a crowd pleaser when he sees it. Yeah, as we talked about on many episodes, including the last one, I think, or the one before last, whatever it was, a recent episode. One of the great mysteries of the 1980s is why the American original theatrical cut of Highlander had the flashback to Rachel in World War II taken out, because everyone loves that scene and it also explains her entire character. And the final scene with her and Connor, when he leaves and says, you'll have everything you need, you've got power of attorney, makes no sense without that scene.
Yeah, and nor does It's a Kind of Magic.
Nor does It's Kind of Magic, that's right.
Nor does the final thing that he says to her. It's like...
Yes, and one of the most famous lines in the film, that's right. That's actually more important than he is. Very true.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, It's a Kind of Magic.
You're not coming back. Even if you kill him, you're not coming back, are you?
Sweet Rachel, you always knew this would happen. Russell Nash dies tonight. Hey, it's a Kind of Magic.
Yeah, Sid Sheinberg, very, you know, patriarchal in his way, but he knew a crowd-pleasing movie, because of course he was a mentor to Spielberg, wasn't he? So yes, he knew a crowd pleaser. He would have kept in the scene in World War II. Anyway, that's enough about Sid Sheinberg, someone who had nothing to do with this film. Is it a Universal film, Rob? No, not even that. Not even a Universal
Sid
film.
Sid Sheinberg, when are you going to release my podcast?
Yeah, sorry. Brilliant.
Yes, if only people wishing that we'd taken the same approach to editing is...
Well, the really... Actually, I just realised, oh my God, the really interesting thing, and I keep saying that as well, everything's really interesting. We live in interesting times. The really interesting thing is that Sid Sheinberg was married to Lorraine Gary.
Gary, yeah.
Who plays Ellen Brody. So basically denied his wife a much bigger part in this film where she would have been the heroine of the movie. Sorry, Lorraine, but it's all about what's going to sell the most tickets and tubs of popcorn. And you being the heroine of the film and having as much agency as Roy, just not going to cut it, I'm afraid. So even though I love you, you're going to have probably 12 to 15 pages in this film rather than, say, 40. Anyway.
Yeah. There's lots to unpack there.
So back to Highlander.
But yes, at this point, obviously, Connor and the Kurgan, they fall through the skylight. They fall sideways through the skylight, which is clearly like a... In the way it's been constructed on the set, is clearly almost like a greenhouse. That because, you know, they go over and into it, and obviously the film cuts them falling into the warehouse space. But their legs just kind of get stuck on the edge because it's clearly the bottom of it is clearly just level with the rest of the set.
Which I didn't even notice until you pointed it out when we were watching it together. But yeah, when they fall through the skylight, they stop immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see at the very, very end of that shot that they are no longer falling. But I'd never noticed that before. And now you've ruined it for me. Thank you. It's like in 2001 when people say how the floating pen was done, and when you're told how it's done, you can never unsee it. And it's like, oh, I liked it when I didn't know that. So anyway, I'm not going to say how that was done. It's on the internet. But if you want to know how the floating pen was done from 2001, you can spoil it for yourself.
And then you've got the tilt shot from the bottom of the warehouse space with Connor and the Kurgan falling, and close-ups of them. Clearly, you know, pick-up shots of them being like, ah!
But I think it's one of those where they're still on wires with those pick-up shots. I think that it's another take of them falling, but the camera's on a telephoto lens and has zoomed into them. Because they're still obviously falling.
Yeah.
And it's on a blue screen. It's like they are falling in a physical space, but they're not falling. They're being lowered at some speed on a wire, but not terminal velocity. But it is, I can't think of another film outside of Hong Kong action films where characters fall on wires. And in Hong Kong action films, they're not really falling, they tend to be flying or gliding. So this film is quite, I think, unique, but if anyone knows of other examples, please let us know, of trying to show that a character is falling by having them being lowered on a wire rather than using a blue screen or something.
It's especially because the room itself is blue. Russell Mulcahy refers to it as the blue room.
He does refer to it as the blue room, yeah.
And the fact it takes them a long time to fall a distance. It's a long distance, you know, it's maybe 100 feet, but it's not that far. I mean, it's very clear from this, obviously, that, you know, expanding on the lore, that immortals are descended from birds.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah, they are. They have spontaneous evolution and their avian genes just kick in every now and again and enable them to kind of glide down.
Cue the X-Men sting from the...
Okay, right.
Yeah.
We have fans and boy do we service them.
I mean X-Men fans. I don't know what they're listening to this podcast, but...
I'm sure there is a huge crossover between X-Men fans and Highlander fans. You could almost say that the Venn diagram would be a circle. I have no data to prove that. But sorry, what do you think in terms of that, though, of having an actor on a wire being lowered at speed to denote falling? What do you think when you watch that?
Well, the thing is, the fact that they're not falling for that shot, you're not below them, and you're kind of slightly below them from the side. Because you're below them from the side, it doesn't really make any difference because...
But you do get some big wides, though, of them doing it.
Yeah, well, I think more in terms of the closer shots... Because you can't judge how fast they're falling anyway because the camera's keeping pace with them. So you get the idea of, like, you could cheat it by running something in the background behind them going up. Like, you could equally, they don't have to be falling in that shot. Because of the way it's shot, you don't get any very hard to gauge movement anyway. So you could cheat it. You could cheat it far more easily and probably effectively. Like, again, doing what they used to do in the old films by running a screen behind them to make it look like, because in this case, it's just like, they're falling, I guess.
Yeah.
And there is some very broad acting in this as well.
I think, the bit when you get the close-ups of them falling. But yeah, that's one of those things where it's like, because they are falling on a wire, it's not the same as Alan Rickman at the end of Die Hard, when they said, we're going to drop you on 3, 1, 2, boom, and he gets dropped. So that look of surprise on his face as he starts falling is real. Because here it's like, well, you're being lowered on a wire. So you have to act that you're falling. It's like nothing really... You can't, I think, properly do the surprise of falling.
It's very much from the school of the Star Trek, the ship is under attack, everybody rocks simultaneously.
It is.
Shout out to Karen and Jesse.
Yes, indeed. But in that wide shot of them falling, I'm not saying that it's bad, I'm just saying that it's an interesting choice to say, this is how we're going to show that our characters are falling, but we're not going to your point, suggest that, but we're not going to your point, suggest that they fall in a different way because they're immortal. They don't have any powers that would stop them from just plummeting. So we're just going to do this instead. And it's like, okay, so it's weird that you chose to do that. It's not bad. It's just very, very weird that you chose to show them falling in a way that's like, well, they're falling slowly. Okay. They're falling slowly in regular gravity.
then they hit the ground. And when they hit the ground, it's clear they cut to kind of a wide of them hitting the ground. It's clear that essentially Christopher Lambert and Clancy Brown have basically been told, like, jump up in the air and fall on the ground.
Yeah, indeed.
Try and do it simultaneously.
On 3, 1, 2, 3, jump up.
Yeah, because you don't actually see the proper moment of impact.
Yeah.
And when they come down inside the warehouse space was shot at King George V Dock, which is now London City Airport. I think the wall behind them, the big blue wall of glass, pretty much lines up with where the actual runway is nowadays.
So where is London City Airport? Because I'm not entirely sure.
It's north of the river. It's essentially north of the river, pretty much parallel with, like, Woolwich.
Okay.
If Woolwich is on the south of the river, then London City Airport's on the north.
Right, yeah.
It's east of Canary Wharf.
Right, okay. A little bit of geography for all of our London file Highlander fans.
It's expensive to fly from there, but it is, if you're based in central London, it is super convenient.
I've never actually been there.
I flew from there earlier this year. And I got there super early in the morning. I got there about 3 hours. My flight was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I got there at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And the airport wasn't open yet. I literally had to wait outside for about half an hour because the whole fucking airport was closed.
Wow.
It's like, you don't turn up. Well, hey, I'm sure you can turn up at Heathrow and Gatwick and they won't let you in because the airport's closed. But
yeah, I think they do close the airports. It's weird though, isn't it, when it's like, no, we're shut. Really? I don't think the airport's shut like a Tesco. We do. We do indeed.
But they did put the shutters down. there wasn't much to do other than sort of sit there and read a book and look at the sultry, on those kids' rides, the ones that rock back and forth. And they started the thing up saying, please don't use this due to COVID.
What, so like an elephant or something that you can ride in and, right? Okay then, is there anything else to talk about? So now we're on to London City Airport. Anything else to talk about with this particular sequence?
No, I think that's it for me.
I think that's all my notes as well. There's a sign, actually, in the background. You don't see it so much in this episode, but in the previous one you do. Or Eagle Electronics.
Yes.
You see that. Perfection is not an accident. That's their slogan. That's a great slogan. It's also like a mantra for this podcast, I suppose.
Exactly.
And like them, we also have over 2,000 electrical products.
Please come and buy them. My garage is full of toasters.
Yes. And defunct laptops.
Yes.
Rob's got a bunch of old laptops. It's like a laptop graveyard in your flat. It's like all these ancient laptops you haven't thrown away.
Going back to like my teenage years, and I've because like, what the fuck do you do with an old laptop? I know there are very clear answers to that. If you have an answer to that, please write in.
It's like, you recycle it. You can drop it off at this point. Absolutely. eBay. There are some. What do you do with like a 2004 laptop? Anyway.
Crack it open for the rare earth minerals.
That's right, yes. And then as you were saying, eat them and see if you become immortal too. I didn't become immortal. But I did lose...
What is the opposite of being immortal?
But I did lose a lot of my eyesight. So I'm a bit like Christopher Lambert now. So that's kind of immortal, right? Anyway. Okay, well, if there's nothing else to talk about, then Mr. Wallace, thank you for joining me on this, as we said before, kind of solo chat for a sequence towards the end of Highlander.
No, thank you.
And if people wanted to find you on the internet, to find out more of your musings, where could they do that?
You can find me on Twitter at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. Mr. Daniel and I actually also host another podcast, which is more generally about movies, which is called The Movie Robcast. And you can listen to that wherever you're listening to this. You can also follow that on Twitter at Movie Robcast, or, you know, drop us an email. It'd be great to hear from you at movierobcast@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. So the Movie Robcast is more general than talks about
Sid Sheinberg. City Airport and my
Brazil
and my laptop graveyard. Yeah, my laptop graveyard. It's like, sorry.
There is a young adult book there.
Yeah. My Chemical Romance.
my laptop graveyard. Cool. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, then I'm at @Rob_A_Daniel. You can follow my writing at electric-shadows.com. If you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, then you can do at McLeod Time. You can also drop us a Highlander-themed email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com. And if you've liked what you've heard, then why not rate and or review us? It just takes a second to leave a star rating. And while you're there, you might want to leave some words. Anyway, if you choose to do that, thank you very much. It is always much appreciated, and it helps the podcast and all those algorithms and whatnot. So, well, Rob, shall we take them out with a resounding rendition of Another Time, McLeod?
Yes, and so on three?
Yeah.
One, two, another!
Sorry. When you said on three, I'm panicking now because I think it means one, two, and then go, but it's, maybe it doesn't. Anyway.
Sorry, yes.
So shall we go? Well,
calm down, Alan Rickman.
Yeah, that's right. It all ties in. You see? Okay, so shall we go one, two, three, then do it?
Yes.
Okay. One, two, three.
Another time, McLeod! Another time,
McLeod! Lovely.
And I even vaguely did it as Alan Rickman.
You did, that's right.
Another time, McLeod. McLean. Another time, McLean!
Very good.